The following conversation between our prestigious guest, Georges Tessot and Jürgen Meyer, comes as a celebration of our yearly David Azraeli Lecture in Architecture here at the School of Architecture. The idea of organizing a conversation between a theorist and a practitioner stems from the nature of my discussion with Martin Bressani and David Azraeli. In the past year, we had the chance of meeting several times, and it was always an opportunity to discuss informally about our vision, the state of architectural knowledge today, the influence of historical and theoretical claims. I therefore would like to thank David Azraeli for these delightful moments and his great support in making such events possible in the School of Architecture. This informal and creative atmosphere that reunites the historian, the theorist, and the world-renowned architect is what we would like to convey to you this morning. In the past year, our student committee on lectures organized similar sessions that reunited student groups with our guests. And here I would like to thank the students, Fuzi, Alexandre, Martina, and Ziao. So today, we decided to adopt a model by which our two prestigious guests will be moderated by Olivier Jacques, a new PhD candidate who is now part of our community. In fact, Olivier knows very well the protagonist of this discussion. He indeed worked with Jürgen Meyer in Berlin while being the assistant of Georges Tessot at Laval University. So Olivier, maybe you will be able to report on some insight moments and crispy stories while working with Georges and Jürgen.
Be careful, I can return them. Huh?
So it's up to you. All right. So Olivier will actually introduce our two guests and will describe their backgrounds. All I wanted to say is that I believe, from knowing them, that it's going to be about curves, clouds, and crystals, as Georges would put it. And so, without further delay, I would like to ask you just to turn off your cell phones and your computers to sit and relax. And we will, of course, offer you the possibility to intervene in this discussion, in the second part of the discussion. So please join me in welcoming Georges Tessot, Jürgen Meyer, and Olivier Jacques. Thank you.
And I'm here if you need me. Okay.
So I'll start standing to present both of the protagonists, and then I'll sit to start the discussion. And like I'll talk for 3 or 5 minutes to just launch the conversation on a specific theme, and then we will see how they can stop talking to each other. So founded in 1996 in Berlin, Germany, Jürgen Meyer H. Architects Studio focuses on works at the intersection of architecture, communication, and new technology. Recent projects include the town hall is in Ostfildern. It's not that recent anymore, but still. A student center in Karlsruhe University, the redevelopment of the Plaza de Encarnacion in Sevilla, Spain, and multiple civic structures in Georgia, such as an airport building, a courthouse, and a police station in the city of Mestia. Jürgen Meyer H. is the founder and principal of this cross-disciplinary studio. He studied at Stuttgart University, the Cooper Union, and Princeton University under the direction of Georges Tessot. His work has been published and exhibited worldwide and is part of numerous collections, including MoMA New York, SF MoMA, and national and international awards include Mies van der Rohe Award, Emerging Architect Special Mention 2003, and winner Olsim Award Bronze 2005. Jürgen Meyer H. has taught at Princeton University, University of the Arts Berlin, Harvard University, Kunsthochschule Berlin, the Architectural Association in London, the Columbia University in New York, and the University of Toronto in Canada. Georges Tessot has taught history and theory of architecture at the Instituto Universitario di Architettura of Venice, Italy, and at Princeton University School of Architecture, where he was also director of the PhD program in architecture at the Department of Architecture, and he also taught at the Department of Architecture at the ETH, Zurich, and he is now, since 2002, a professor at Laval University School of Architecture in Quebec City. He has co-edited with Monique Mossard a volume entitled The History of Garden Design in 2000. He has written the introduction of the Diller and Scofidio volume Flesh Architectural Probes 1995, and was co-curator with De Lorenz Cofidio also of an exhibition on the American lawn, Surface of Everyday Life, at the Canadian Center of Architecture in 1998. He is the editor of The American Lawn, published in 1999. Latest publications include the theme of Jugendstil and Träumhaus in the writings of Walter Benjamin, the experimental architecture of open source architecture with two projects as example, and yet to be published, his new book titled Topology of Everyday Constellations, coming next spring. I am personally pleased to have both of you here for this David Azrieli architectural talk, and I welcome you today on behalf of McGill University School of Architecture. Start the discussion. If it still works, okay. So, Monsieur Tessot, Professor Tessot, latest researchers on the matter of topology, oriented me on what I would suggest at the first topic of this discussion. The introduction of digital tools in everyday architectural practice at the end of the 90s allowed for a major shift in plasticity and malleability of the architectural form. With new possibilities in continuity, convergence and connectivity, some key pioneers in deconstructivism, such as Greg Lynn, Ben van Berkel, or Peter Eisenman, helped defining a new topological movement in architecture. This was sustained at the turn of the century with an increased influence of Deleuze's work in the field of architecture theory, with actualized consideration for Leibniz, the fold, Baroque outlines, and expressionism. From 1994 to 2006, the terrain on which digital architecture unfolded was merely that of virtual image, the space within the computer screen, and the simple access in the potentiality offered by new digital apparatus and architecture of gadgets. Since then, few architects such as Toyo Ito, open source architecture, and Jürgen Meyer H., for instance, have explored the actual materiality and fabricability of this topological movement. Such an architecture chooses to embrace the potential of the curve to be inclusive rather than conflicting, to activate rather than antagonize, to appeal the appeal for catastrophe theories has moved to an apt mediation on architecture within multiple sphere, from public to domestic, from intimate to extimate, if I might cite Georges Tessot's writings. An exact geometry of the early movements became precise arcs, filleted surface, and chamfered end edges. Here, within a language of precise B-splines, NURBS, alignments on the architecture of contour, the design crushes previous requirements in built tectonics. One does not inhabit the space of columns, roof, and floors. One now inhabits the spline. One finds shelter in algorithms. What remains is only continuity, only convergence, only connectedness, a real, actual topological revolution. So that's the main theme I approached for this talk. I could suggest questions, precise questions, but I'm sure it already sparks some ideas for the discussion.
And the question is for me.
Should I ask precise? I could actually ask precise.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I understand that. Okay. I just wanted to know if you were talking to Jürgen.
I came here totally unprepared, so I don't know what's going to happen. There was a secret about the conversation this morning. So let's see how it works.
So the question was for Georges Tessot.
I understand your question. During the 90s, around 2000 and 2005, somebody was speaking of digital tectonics. So I think one of the questions of discussion could be, and I have a problem with the concept of digital tectonics, but I'm not against it. It's not like it hurts me or... But in the same time, it could be a subject of discussion. Point two is, it's true, since 2000, 2001, with the help of software and even customizable software, like Maya and all that has been developed since, there is maybe the possibility to topologize and to re-topologize our architecture. So opening a fantastic field. And I think, of course, part of the work of Jürgen illustrates that very well, and he was one of the first to illustrate it. Do we need the tectonics? I have friends in Italy, in France who are crying about the end of tectonics. But maybe tectonics is not out. It's still a concept we can use. We just have to adapt it. It's a point of discussion. During the 19th century, when new materials were introduced, like steel, iron, metals, a new stereotomy was introduced. The stereotomy of building built with this new materials. And new types of spaces were created. Transparency of the metal, transparency of the glass, etc. This was a revolution during the 19th century. We all know, but sometimes we have to come back to jump forward, to have to come back on those things. With the digital technology and techniques, what we have to understand, do we need still the concept of tectonics, which was, you know, as you know, everybody knows, rethought by by Gottfried Semper, for instance, or is it the very concept of tectonics that disappears? That's one of the questions I think should be asked today. If you read all what has been written recently, I mean, you will find people who are for a kind of new digital tectonics and some people saying that let's get rid of tectonics. I think Greg Lynn would be more like let's get rid of it. Some other people still think it's important. So that would be my first answer. Is that okay? I can continue for 1 hour, but...
Well, I always think it's interesting to see that there is hardly a discussion about, let's say, a Brutalist or a 70s architecture with the chamfered corner, where I see the beginning of a different kind of sculptural understanding of space and a continuous, you know, surface discussion. That's kind of when I had my eye-opening moment, and my little theory is that you always rework your childhood somehow. My childhood was in the early 70s, and if you think about this kind of international style that so far nobody wrote about, and I don't know why, there's something that appeared all over the world, from Japan to, you know, America to Europe, the idea of mostly concrete, concrete architecture that has these kind of angled, and it works in all dimensions and directions, and it just appeared somehow, and you might know better where, you know, where it came from, but there was somehow an international agreement that this is an architecture that represents something, and we still have to find out maybe what this is. But it's the first move to cut the corner, and, you know, if you think about splines, the spline basically just keeps cutting the edges, so in a way it's kind of spline 101. And I think that's kind of when we thought about how an all-inclusive environment, how, you know, a surface wraps from floor to a ceiling to walls, you know, beyond tectonic ideas, I guess. Also, coming with different understandings of spaces, materiality of spaces, you know, the carpet all of a sudden walked up the walls, smell and light and sound was part of a different understanding of space. So I think there was something in there which was then kind of moved into a different direction for a while, which can be rediscovered. But if you think about the chamfered corner, it kind of became a cheap arcade, you know, in the 80s when postmodernism was up to date. And it became kind of a historic motif. But in the end, actually, it started with an understanding of a sculptural, architectural language that now was, I think, pushed forward with the idea of computerization and digitalization, where these architectures or these first moves became much more complex and developed something that you discussed about spline issues in architecture. So that's somehow where I see an origin in kind of the recent history of our culture. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Why didn't ever any talk about the chamfered architecture?
No, because you did, so.
But do you have an idea where it came from? Like, why did it appear all of a sudden?
No, I think it's an interesting... It's like the continuation of brutalism and the corporate architecture all over the world.
It's not just corporate. I mean, if you look at...
Give me an example.
So non-corporate.
Huh?
Of non-corporate.
Of chamfered...
Well, if you look at Alfred Huth's work in Graz, you know, like the Graz school in the 70s, you see that a lot. You see it in, I don't know, the library in Toronto, you know, you see it in Israel, you know, in, I don't know, some kind of national museums. You see it in, I mean, it's everywhere. You just have to open your eyes.
But I think I think Metropole Parasol speaks something more. It's not just cutting the edges and suppressing the very idea of ceiling. I think you're diminishing what you have done by saying it comes from the 70s.
No, but I'm saying we didn't talk about Metropole Parasol yet. We talked about the spline, and I think the spline idea in architecture somehow has a history, and I was wondering why that part was never discussed. At least I think it's kind of an obvious source, but maybe not.
No. I understand what you mean.
Just a personal interpretation.
You have another question, or shall I continue?
I could continue on this. I voluntarily left the parasol on the side for the beginning because I thought there's something interesting in what Georges is writing at the moment, and the development of an architectural language more like that is that the Metropole Parasol was the culmination of, but. Maybe if I ask the question to Jürgen a little bit, because Georges approached it and I approached it also in the description, but there it seems like in many projects, if I think of the Karlsruhe Mensa, for example, it seems like the building, when you look at it, it seems like it's completely skinned of tectonics. It seems like the building is... the surface of the building is more important, and then there's... When tectonics disappear, it seems like a kind of strangeness or a kind of voluntary strangeness comes out of the architectural form. And I'm just curious, what is when one voluntarily blurs the transition between the material, the construction, and the whole tectonic of the building? When one voluntarily skin it out of the building, is it a move towards also a voluntary strangeness or something like this? I don't know if it rings any bell.
Well, that building is a little bit of an ambiguous project, and I think it shows a transitory situation. It's a prefab timber construction, and I don't know if somebody knows it, but it is a prefab timber construction, which is very tectonic in the way it kind of reduces the construction time and cost. And then, you know, we had to kind of fill in the round corners, and in the end, it was all sprayed on with this polyurethane coating. That makes kind of the skin that kind of envelopes the whole thing.
The border point in Georgia is a little bit the same treatment, where somehow the tectonics disappear also, I think.
Yes, yeah. And so what you have, in a way, is a production process that in Metropole Parasol, in the end, is much further developed, because there the curves actually are the built structure and are the ones that are kind of prefabricated but also put on place with that original geometry. With Metropole Parasol, it was meant to be like that, but in the end the cost issue was more efficient. You know, you lose less wood when you cut out... you would lose more wood when you cut out all the curves. In that case, it was easier to actually assemble all of that. That wasn't possible in this case, in the Metropole Parasol. But in a way, that's kind of a mixture between a tectonic approach and a kind of an enveloping with the surface treatment in the end. Although that was part of the tectonics, because then you save material, it was weather protected. So it's not an easy issue or like a clear issue. There's always kind of ambivalence between the two.
Well, I just wanted to ask you what was your point of that? In every school in the 90s, and because, as usual, of our friend Peter, the diagram was everywhere. So let's have just a moment of reflection of the diagram. And we could just decide we don't like the diagram, we don't want to speak anymore of the diagram, that the diagram is out. It's very possible. But the diagram did bring something to the teaching, I think. Because it was considered as an abstract map, first of all, and then it was possible to build this map through modeling, etc., 3D modeling, etc. Through the use of algorithm. So let's say you have diagram BC, before the digital period, but maybe the algorithm did permit a new comprehension, a new use, a new application of the diagram. And one of my many ideas is, but first of all, the diagram through digital tools permit probably to topologize architecture. So that would be one of my first questions. So I'll stop here, just to be clear.
Well,
diagram, yes or no, and does diagram with digital tools permit to topologize architecture?
Well, it depends, like, when do you need a diagram? If you need it to explain the project, if you make the diagram afterwards to kind of create a history of the process, you know, that is kind of a reworked history. And I think there's a shift of how the diagram was used when I was still in school or in the beginning, like in the 90s. I think it was a tool to understand certain logistics at work and like try to help you to come up with arguments for your design. Now I see the diagram more as something that's a sales point, like how you can make it like easy for people to understand what you did, and therefore they say yes, you know, it's kind of a very positivistic argument. But I still would agree that the diagram helps while you're in the design process to always kind of reevaluate at what stage you are in clarifying what the design means or where it's going to go. So I don't think it's an obsolete element, but it depends how you use it, and therefore the audience always is a different audience, I guess, and therefore the diagram also changes.
You want to say something?
No,
but you can't stop us, you know. Just as a variety, you know, it's a show. The TV is here. You have to be brutal. You have to interrupt us. You have to invent the fact that you disagree with us.
But then I would, okay, then I would.
You know, it's like this story, you know, if a dog bites a man, it's a boring. But if a man starts to bite a dog, that's the beginning of a good story.
But then I would just call you again on the same questions, like about the when did the introduction of either algorithm or the computer tools in your practice introduce a new topologies, like a new form of like are your projects enhanced by these new tools, or what did they bring to the practice?
Well, I think we have a very sculptural understanding of working, and that also includes that, you know, it's kind of an object rather than, you know, a project that, you know, needs to be looked at from all different kinds of whatever dimensions, from interior, from exterior. And, of course, the algorithms and, you know, the computerization and the computer programs help to do that. I don't think, you know, that they are the source of our work, but they're very helpful to design these things. So, you know, if you look at our early work, it's much more, let's say, edgy or, let's say, boxy, and you also see some of our current work. So I think what allows us with, you know, this computerization, that we can work on this whole graduation from, let's say, the right angle through the chambers, you know, to a chamfered corners, you know, to the round one, and I don't see much of a difference. It's actually kind of a decision on where to put yourself on that scale. Conceptually, I don't see a difference. Of course, you know, it might look different, but in the end, it's about how these architectures in the end allow for certain spaces, allow for extra spaces, options to come up with programs in the future beyond the program. And the buildings, or let's say the designs, somehow are contextual, so they react to something that we find is interesting on the site, to extract that and like make that into an architectural object. Yes, most of the cases, they're more curvy than rectilinear, but it's not because we believe in, you know, the spline as the only architectural suggestion, but it's mostly the thing that works best for us in this case. But it's actually, you look at it as on a scale. That's why I'm actually coming back to the chamfered corner. I think that's a very initial moment where you make the first moment from like a rectangular corner towards something in there that's a spline. And I think that's where something changed in architecture. And I'm curious at what moment that actually happened. And I'm coming back to my first issue. You know, you're the historian, George. Like, what happened there? You know, what happened in the 70s or in the late 60s? You know, what, like, is there maybe a first project that introduced that? Because I think you cannot ignore it. And it's more than just a formal gesture. It's actually something that talks about a different idea of culture and society and how that space kind of envelopes us, you know, as an enveloping architecture. And in the end, it might end up in a project like Metropole Parasol, where you have kind of an elastic urban space that allows for different kind of public to use our kind of, you know, squares and urban possibilities. And it might be just the end point of something that happened much earlier.
Well, I think that there are two issues. If we speak of Metropole Parasol, we can speak of digital tools, but also in general of what you succeeded, in my opinion, very well, is to create I don't know how to call it. Maybe a machine for making emotions. And I did realize that it was really working when I saw in July, I think, well, Spain won the football cup.
Soccer, yeah.
The World Cup, yeah. And there was the World Cup. Of course, I watched the World Cup because I'm European and I hate hockey. I can't even see the ball and nobody explained me the rules. I hate baseball. I'm old soccer. So it was a great moment for me, great moment for Spain. And everybody was under Metropole Parasol. So at a certain moment, the social chemistry clicked. Suddenly, the whole Spain was there. The whole television, the people. Nobody was discussing if the project was good or bad, or up and down, or if it had a good relation with the history of the city. Suddenly, it was a machine organizing the emotions of people. I know it has been used also for other purposes. So we can develop that idea. But that image in July of the World Cup plus Metropole Parasol, I knew before that it was going to work. But that was the confirmation. And since then, I think there have been many. Just imagine the shopkeepers who know nothing about architecture loves it. They love Metropole Parasol. Because your project has a capacity of transforming completely this part of the town. And big and good projects do that. I mean, if you take Arthur Erickson's locals in Vancouver, that's exactly what it did. A good project, because that part of Vancouver, I saw the historical photo, was derelict. Nobody wanted to live there. So a good project transformed that part of Vancouver. Your project transformed that part of Sevilla, which was sort of half abandoned, not really dynamic. There was a huge problem from an urban point of view. So you created an atmospheric machine for making emotion, for containing emotions. So I think that's very good. And that's why we love to talk about this project. Now, if we become more technical, there is something else also that happened there. Yes? We have to stop?
No. Martin asked me, because I don't know if many people in the room know actually about the project Metropole Parasol, so maybe I'll just make a brief description of the project,
yeah.
and so people can figure out what we're
Absolutely.
Talking about. But basically, it was a project for the... Maybe Jürgen should describe it, or should I?
I can describe it.
Yeah, please.
But then basically, I'm already giving my lecture for tonight. I'll come back at 6:30.
Keep your lecture.
Yeah.
I'll do it. But there was a competition in 2004 to give a new life to a city lot in the center of Sevilla, and J. Meyer H. Architecten won the competition, and basically built, I would say, six giant connected umbrellas that both cover the place, but also becomes the house of a vertical organization of the public space. So basically, underground, they discovered also historical ruins, which the project displays. And then on the ground floor of the public plaza, there is an indoor public market, and which you can also walk on top. Then it makes the urban plaza vertical, a little bit vertical. And then there's 6 feet of these umbrellas that connects to the public plaza. A cafe inside two of the umbrellas, which you can see here, and this cafe leads to a belvedere. Is it an English word? Yeah, a belvedere, a walkway that goes from on top of six umbrellas and give you a view on the city. So that's a very technical description, but still, and then the structural. The structure of it is mostly it's concrete under, but mostly like some places it's mostly done with the timber because it's all made of wood and timber. So the timber also gives both the structure of the project and its shape and image. And it casts shadows on the public place, which is an important
useful.
Which is useful
in
because
Sevilla.
It's Sevilla, it's hot, and then it's also very symbolic, I think, I would say.
Well, which will lead to question, but later, about air conditioning, but later. I keep that to the end. What I think, you have enough here to understand what's happening. That's Metropole Parasol. What is happening here is a completely new definition of the relation between form and matter. Now, discussing about form and matter, it happens already in Aristotle and before Aristotle and Plato. So it's a long story. And to make a long story short, I don't want to start. Whole story. In the classical meaning of form, form was dynamic and was imposed on matter, so matter was passive. But like matter took the dynamic of the form. So it was a form that gives shape to the matter which was passive. Here, completely different. A new thing has happened, and that's why we're all passionate about this project. That's why we write about it, do lectures about it, and it, for me, just in one word, it's a great paradigm of those years because it's obliged you to rethink about nearly everything in design, of course, but also maybe also in other fields like criticism, architecture, etc. But at least in design. Now, throughout all his work, Deleuze has recommended altering the idea of a mode, because what happened when form is applied to matter is what a mold, one is molded down. When you create a brick, is what happens. And Deleuze, during all his life, has recommended altering the idea of molding by introducing that of modulation. Molding, the old idea. Modulation, the new idea. And I quote, permit me, I quote, in 1978, very, very short, every direction leads us, I believe, to stop thinking in terms of substance form. Substance form is what I was saying before, form matter. Proposing inert matter to active form. And instead, he proposed to substitute it with a process of modulation in which the form-giving operation would be conceived as a coupling of forces and material. And that's what happens here. It's absolutely the new thing. The forces are not only embedded, because every force is embedded in matter. You could say that this ugly, stupid, banal column is embedding some... I mean, if you were in engineering, hey, no problem, these columns bear very well, you know. And I even calculated. But we are overcoming this kind of banality, commonality, everydayness of the column bearing, the bearing column. Because now we have a structure that is putting together the forces at the plural and the materials. Now, how does this happen? I don't want to go into that. You can imagine. It's a long and difficult process. And you can see. You know how long and difficult, but the process of building metropole parasol. What is interesting, we have a confirmation of what people like Deleuze and Guattari in the 70s and 80s were saying, even before the digital period. They say that art should be, or an artistic activity, should be the capture of intensive forces by new materials. The material force couple replaces the matter force couple. And end of the quote. So do you agree with that? You want to develop it? Am I wrong? I got it all wrong? Very possible. Hey, am I projecting my Deleuze reading?
Well, I think that's completely fair, you know, that you do that. And it sounds also good. And I don't think I wouldn't like to kind of add on that. When it comes to the kind of the design process, and that's maybe something that I can, you know, kind of share from our point of view how to get over at this project. For us, it was important to bring in kind of a north-south directed grid that is kind of a starting point for the process that happens within an invisible kind of outer shape form for the project that always kind of was a shape of negotiation. Like this form, in the end, is the line between visible and invisible, and everything that happens inside it, in that kind of form, is built in materiality. Everything that's outside continues, you know, but is invisible. Somehow, like you project that into an endless kind of universal grid, if you like. That after that initial decision to create this boundary between material, immaterial, between inside and outside, you know, of this thing, you know, all the kind of the challenges happened. You can imagine that this. The forces in the end don't work along the grid structure. You know, there's actually something that goes diagonal into the stems and so forth. And that actually fine-tuned and manipulated that kind of first initial neutral grid. You have thickness changes in the wood plates. You have actually sub-tension structures in this thing. So that makes it quite interesting to see how this confrontation of a form and this neutral grid force a completely different kind of rationale and research on how to make the materiality actually happen. And that's what I'm going to show later in the lecture, what are the different solutions, what kind of, you know, material choices we made, what kind of challenges came, and what kind of innovations actually came with this very initial, let's say, concept of inside and outside, you know, of this invisible form-defining element. And in kind of Niklas Luhmann's definition of form, which is always about a kind of a ritual or let's say a norm in society, how to actually create certain standards and confirmations of negotiations within a culture and society. That's somehow what happens also in that project. You know, what to include and what to exclude in an urban project, in a public project like this. But more of that tonight. It became the biggest wood construction in the world, as we are told, and also the largest project when it comes to bonding technology. So it's maybe the largest glued project and the largest timber construction in the world. That's a teaser for tonight.
Yeah. I just want to add just one thing. First, I did check all your competitors because they are still published on various sites.
For the competition?
Yeah. I met a lot of Spanish architects who were and still furious about this project for bad reasons. I went to see the competitors. The majority of them were glass boxes.
But that's what you have these days anyway. In
how can you dare say you don't like this? And you propose a glass, air-conditioned glass box. You know? A non-durable, costly glass box. So I was absolutely scandalized. Hey, you guys, a Spanish architect. Now, I'm not speaking of the good Spanish architect. There are some very interesting architects in Spain. I'm speaking of like the run-of-the-mill standard architect who do all the competition and are very furious when they don't win, like in Quebec, basically. you understand what I mean? Well, some people understand what I mean. So the run-of-the-mill professional say, hey, our project was much better. I won't quote anybody, I'm prudent. Because, you know, I could be killed, okay, they could punch my tires and... Okay, but I'm going to ask a brutal question, just for the provocation and the discussion. You could have done a wooden box with air conditioning, and you didn't. I'm glad you didn't. But just for the sake of discussion, why you didn't do an air conditioning project? Since in Sevilla, it's quite hot during the summer. I'm glad you didn't. It's clear, but
well,
imagine somebody else asks you that.
Yeah. But the you have to go into the history of the competition. The competition was an open ideas competition, and the only thing they asked for was to keep the Roman ruins as an archaeological museum site and to bring back some kind of food market, not air conditioned. It could have been an outdoor market, which was there before somehow, to bring that back and think about what is urban space in the 21st century beyond, you know, these programs. And so there was no clear program except for these like two things they want. And they wanted to really create some kind of an, if you can still say that, iconic project of public space or like a prototype public space for the 21st century.
They were hoping for a Bilbao kind of project?
But they were hoping for a project that shows a different form of public project. And, of course, to compete with other Spanish cities who all had their kind of architectural masterpieces to prove that they are part of the 21st century. So you go to Valencia and see Calatrava, you go to Barcelona and see all these projects there, you go to Bilbao, you go to Tenerife and so forth. So Sevilla, who was considered as kind of...
It didn't work very well in San Giacomo of Compostela.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're still working on it. It's not finished yet. Basically, Sevilla wanted to also be part of that game. And within Spain, it was always considered half Africa, like not part of the Spanish kind of vibration and so forth. So I think that was kind of the last moment that we still were catching, you know, now things like this are impossible. But it also proved that there were possible architectures that survive also this kind of initial like hype for an institutional project, like in the other, you know, like in Valencia, which is kind of a dead space in the center of the city. But it was an open ideas competition, and they selected 10 projects from a first anonymous phase, and the 10 projects were all completely different. They proposed a park in underground spaces. They proposed an open plaza with three towers. They proposed a huge Centre Pompidou, like standing in there. They proposed a very kind of simple, you know, market, so forth. So there was not necessarily a program necessary for a big glass, you know, air-conditioned box. I remembered when I was in Seville in 1992 for the World Expo that it was really hot, and that shadow is a, kind of a key element, a key materiality for the space, and for, you know, being able to be outside in public spaces. So we developed the roof as the initial gesture, and from that one, all the other things kind of happened. We had to select the forces on very limited moments because the archaeology was crucial, so we can only go into the ground in some spaces and so forth. So I still believed in this plaza, which was never really a plaza. It was always an institution, a cloister before, then a bigger cloister, then the market, and now Metropole Parasol, as an open public space rather than you know, a box or a building that actually fills the whole site. So that's a simple question.
I could just add as
you were there,
because I was in the office in 2005, and then I remember at that time it was the exact moment where there was a rush to give the final technical drawings for preliminary technical drawings, because there was more to add afterwards, but still
four syllable words, terrible.
So then there was this rush, and then 2011, so that's 6 years later, I went to the opening with Jürgen, and that's where I will bring something that George mentioned also, because there was, of course, there was this moment of the World Cup where it was an happy celebration under the parasols, but when we were there, I remember maybe a month before the official opening of the project, there was this big like unrest or civil turmoil in Spain, where people got out in the street to manifest or to protest against the Spanish government, and somehow the Plaza de Encarnación became the centerpiece of this protest, and that was few weeks before the official opening, and I remember getting there, and there were already some graffitis and paintings on the projects, but not that many, but still few, and especially some homeless people that would sleep or people that would choose to sleep on the plaza.
No, you're completely wrong. Huh? You're completely wrong.
Am I wrong?
Yes.
Why?
No, actually, this was after the opening. The opening was in March, and the revolution was, you know, happening in different cities. In Madrid, it was on Plaza del Sol. In Sevilla, it was on Metropole Parasol. And actually, it was the people who were active, you know, demonstrating, who slept there. They were sleeping, several not homeless people. They were people from the city.
That was I was about to say. It's not homeless, okay. But just people who chose this place as an agora or somewhere to stay.
Yeah, they were super organized. I mean, every column of Metropole Parasol became like, one was the kitchen area, one was the Wi-Fi information area, one was kind of the, you know, information board when they had discussion groups and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it really became kind of a machine for discussion and for public demonstration, yeah.
But in my souvenir, it was already started at the opening, but...
The opening was in March already. It was too cold.
Ah, okay. So then the
official... There's a question.
Yeah. Anyway...
era that you described, where architecture
Well, atmospheric it is, but I think it is in the way that, in two words, that Sloterdijk in his book speak of air design. It creates an island in the middle of the environment. Up to that kind of building were thrown into an environment, and there was no connection with the environment, and the object was against the environment, and has to cope with the environment. Now I think the direction we're going through, air design, atmospheric architecture, Sloterdijk bubble, etc., the foam, which is the last volume of Sloterdijk spherology, is towards creating an autonomous environment. Just to say in ugly words, because autonomous is such an ugly word. But the nice word would be an island, to create buildings which are actually present themselves as island. And I think Metropole Parasol has this quality. It is an island. It is not an island in the middle of nowhere. It's in the middle of one of the oldest cities of Europe, of course. And it is built on the top of an archaeological site. But it has this island quality. And an island, in our days, can have no reference to the ground. So it alludes to a weightlessness, if I may say, which is atmospheric. Of course, it weighs a lot of tons, the building, literally the building. But the shape of the building alludes to a weightlessness, which I find interesting. Today, contemporary inhabitants have to live and inhabit islands, I think, and with less and less reference to the ground. So that's why maybe the idea of tectonics, which is all anchored in the ground, slowly maybe will disappear. I don't think it will disappear like one day after the other. It will be a slow dissolution. That's one. Did I answer to your question or not? Martin, did I answer?
No, I was more interested in pushing the idea that the atmospheric turns becomes the substance of the architecture, therefore the tectonic of it. I think you're going to use the diagrams, not diagrams, but patterns. The pattern that comes from that kind of reflection.
But
the tectonic tradition is where you're interested in the elements, right? The steam, the streets, and you represent the building structure. So your main task is to present the building in an eloquent, structural way. Whereas here it seems to me that it's not the point.
Well, it's not the point, but actually that was the most critical issue to build it in the end. This was the one that was the biggest challenge in the whole project. So in a way, even if you don't want to deal with tectonics, they still catch you somehow and keep you on the ground. And that actually made the whole process very difficult. But in the end, I think the sources of our work, and I'm showing this tonight also in the lecture with this kind of personal obsession with the patterns, is kind of this idea of a field, of an endless kind of condition where, you know, in moments where you decide to materialize it, it becomes kind of an object, a 3D interpretation, an occupiable space, and a thickening of that surface, of this endless kind of patterned surface, which then becomes a piece of architecture. And in the Metropole Parasol, again, this endless north-south grid, you know, becomes kind of materialized in one specific moment, while you can actually imagine it continuing endlessly. And it's somehow to make a decision on where to materialize this kind of endless field that, you know, it's not stopping at the project, it continues. So in a way, it's an island of articulation rather than, you know, an island of separation. But it's a decision where you actually make it visible. I mean, in a way, I can refer to Peter Eisenman again with his Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, where you also have this idea of an endless field that kind of disappears, but it's decided to make it material at one specific location. But in the end, you have to imagine it as an endless condition that, you know, becomes visible at a certain moment where discussion is important, where moments of reflection of a communal, whatever memorial situation happens. So the conditions are endless, but the moment where it gets where it becomes visible and relevant is where a certain discussion in a cultural context makes it happen.
No, I think you're right. I mean, Toyo Ito's tower already announced that, and then of course Dealer's Cathedral Blur Building. All this is bringing to, I would call it a foam architecture, or an architecture of foam. It doesn't mean it doesn't weight anything, but it confronts itself with climate, weather, air design, creating an artificial environment as an island, etc. I mean, all those themes are, for me, are very important. So I think you're speaking of that, yeah.
But in that sense, I mean, it's creating a certain atmosphere arena with this shadow thing. We are not creating kind of an artificial environment, although there is, of course, a relationship of creating something with high technology in investigations to create a kind of a climate atmosphere that makes it a different place within the city. But also it creates a climate, of course, of a different kind of public life, you know. So that's kind of the after effect. With the Blur Building, it was still like, you know, opening hours, you know, it was like out there, you had to like, it was only open to a selected public, you might have to pay entry fee. In this case here, it is open 24 hours. And in a way, we are lucky because civilians like to be on the streets, and sometimes it's more busy at 2 at night than at 2 in the afternoon. Actually, most of the cases, it's more busy at 2 at night than at 2 in the afternoon. And that makes it a really, you know, truly 24-hour project in all kinds of climates. And so the atmosphere is not just a climatic atmosphere, it's also, I think, a cultural atmosphere.
El Mundial. El Mundial. The moon, the soccer.
Any questions from the?
I have a question.
Okay.
So thank you very much. To reassure you, Jürgen, I had no clue either where that discussion would go to. So not like we're in the same situation. But there was one thing that was very interesting is when you mentioned that this building has probably the biggest load of glue. And that actually refers to that question of tectonics, because in fact one of the latest article of Greg Lean was called "From Tectonics to Cooking Bag," where Greg Lean would consider that the future of the building technologies is about gluing, about cooking, about chemical reactions, and not anymore about nuts and bolts. So. The ambiguity, and that's how I understand your question or your comment, is this ambiguity between the glue and then at the end something that is, you know, very much about the material, right? I think that the hidden agenda of Georges was to make sure that you are still Deleuzian. So I think that was, you know, just to make sure. But I think that question of forces, in a way, reinforces this ambiguity and that question. In a way, there is a history, I think, of continuous surfaces. In a recent history, I think that Martin would argue that it's much older, and I tend to agree, of course. But you know, starting from Kiesler, Endless House, to Rem Koolhaas' Luxor Theater, where suddenly in SMLXL. Koolhaas mentioned, oh, you see, the floor is becoming a wall, is becoming a ceiling, isn't it beautiful? You know, that was his comment. Then MVRDV, of course, that takes up on those things. But I think that the definition that they had about the continuous surface is still very different than yours. I think in their case, it was about programs, it was about the surface of events. But I'm looking at your at Metropole Parasol and all your other projects, and I have the feeling that that spline or that the chamfered corner or the continuous surface has a different meaning in your case. I don't think it's so much about programs. I'm looking at that Metropole Parasol, for instance. Some of the columns are actually tilted, right? So there is a feeling that the forces on that building is about doing probably what we love most in architecture, that is to cantilever things. Like, we always think that cantilevering is beautiful, and people love cantilevers. So is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's different. It's not about a program. It's about this kind of more enveloping idea of, inclusive ideas, exclusive inclusive ideas of atmospheres, rather than the programmatic, endless kind of surfaces. And I agree with you, cantilevers are like crème fraîche in cooking. You can save any building, with a cantilever. It makes it, a cool building. So that is kind of, it's something that seems to be kind of inherent in our spatial understanding. That's true.
Are there more questions? Olivier? Okay. You want to say a last word? Would you like to say a last word? We've got a lot of students over here.
George said he wants to talk about Gothic and Baroque. You coded for
Gothic. Yes, you had that question, yeah.
I was asking an easy one. Okay.
I was curious what you meant by that.
Well, Deleuze spends a lot of time on the line, and he speaks of the nomadic line, and actually the only thing that the nomadic line is, it is not a Renaissance ordered orthogonal line. So he loves Gothic lines. He reads Vohringer on Gothic architecture. I was really surprised to discover that, because I used to give Vohringer at Princeton to the PG student. And they hated it because, this is German theory. We don't like to read that guy. He's boring. But they were wrong, but maybe I was wrong too, because I wasn't explaining well enough why we must read Vohringer still today. And there is a fantastic definition of the dynamic line of the Gothic. So that's point number one. Point number two is a Baroque, because if you can make a whole reading of Deleuze's book on Leibniz, and it's a book about the Baroque. This is obvious, number two. But you could say, no, not at all. I was much more thinking about Gaudi or whoever in Catalonia. I'm leaving the door open to any kind of interpretation.
They all might be true. I think one of the references we have for the project was the cathedral in Sevilla, the cathedral, which is actually a Baroque structure, where the structure and the what you see as a structure is also kind of what is structurally true, more or less. In a way, Seville, the Metropole Parasol, has the same dimension, it's the same height, it's kind of the same whatever proportions, and what you see also is kind of the structure. But while Baroque still, is kind of following the loads and following the line of the forces, ours is actually faking, it's not about the efficient line of the forces going down. The north-south grid, is actually against the radial forces that go into a stem. So in a way, it's a different kind of representation of structure, and it's maybe also kind of an irritating, ambivalent idea of showing structure versus, the forces. Maybe Gothic was more about trial and error. If you look at the big cathedrals and all that structures that came outside, how often did they have to build something and it fell down and then they tried again? So the idea of dematerialization, I think, is also an important aspect in Gothic architecture. While I like it more clumsy and heavy, so maybe the Baroque works better in the end effect of the weight the clumsiness of or the boldness of an architecture. So I think it has both in it, but for different reasons. Kind of a feeling for a certain heaviness while referring to a weightlessness, as you say, and at the same time a kind of ambiguity about showing a structural kind of reality that might not actually be the true reality when it comes to forces.
Okay, I'll just have a few words to conclude. I think at one point George mentioned the project as an emotional machine, and then the question of Martin also brought the idea of an enclosed atmosphere, and when I failed to say earlier about the protest under the project is that I remember reading the first text that you wrote about the project, and it says that one of its goals was to be to create a democratic space for the city of Sevilla, and I think at one point it succeeds that in the way that it creates an interior on the outside, an open interior, and this is probably this open interior that creates that depends both on the atmospheric, like the shadows and the pattern of the cantilopes, and in a way this interior is responsible for the emotional machine, or creates the emotional machine that George talked about. So
I always thought it was also a vertical Plaza Mayor. I mean, if you take the Spanish Plaza Mayor, it's surrounded by arcades. It's a fantastic public space. But unless you are into some kind of postmodern thing, you don't do that anymore. So it was literally taking the Plaza Mayor with all its program, its activity, its emotions, its activity, and doing slowly, clack, this movement, and say, well, what happens now? And how would we build it?
Okay. Jürgen, you want to add something? Or?
Well, it's also an interesting reference. I mentioned these plazas, like Plaza Real or Plaza Mayores, as something that is actually quite different, because there it's a frame, or like, you know, like San Marco in Venice, it's a frame that unifies kind of the surrounding and creates an open square, you know, which allows all kinds of different programs. The reference in our project, since it was always an object, it was never really a plaza. The street, like the facades on the plaza are all, you know, kind of very nervous. You have a small building, you have a big building, because they all were small LA facades. They were never meant to be a plaza facade. So there was always an object actually occupying this thing. So plazas, like, for example, in Krakow, at the big marketplace, where you have, you know, two buildings occupying the space. In Berlin, the Breitscheidplatz, you know, with the memorial church. Actually, kind of, let's say, magnets, you know, that attract different kinds of programs were more of a guiding understanding of a public space rather than the frame that allows it to have an empty plaza. So these were kind of reference points in trying to understand how an object can attract different forms of public life rather than just a frame.
So I'll personally thank Georges Tessot from Quebec and Jürgen Meyer for coming from Berlin, and he's leaving this evening. So Yeah, and so FDA Auditorium this evening, there's an actual lecture from Jürgen, and so you'll be able to see what we discussed in image with projects and examples. So I thank you all for coming, and I would like to thank David Ezrieli and also Aaron for organizing it.
And Anne-Marie.
And Anne-Marie, of course. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.